Diana Beresford Kroger calls herself a renegade scientist. She's a botanist, a medical biochemist, and an expert on the healing properties of trees. She's also an avid gardener. On her 160-acre property in Ontario, Canada, she's planted more than 100 different species of trees. Some of them, she believes, contain cures for cancer and other illnesses. In a new essay collection called The Global Forest, Beresford Kroger writes that trees are sacred. She told Anne Strainchamps that the lives of trees and humans are interrelated all the way down to the most basic molecular level.
Well, they are sister molecules working together, as a matter of fact. They're both designed by the genome. In one case, in the case of you and I, they're designed by our own genetic code. And in the case of the tree, all trees, they're designed by the tree itself. For us, it's the hemoglobin. For you and I, the hemoglobin is an important oxygen transporter into our blood system, and in fact that keeps us alive. It is really the only thing that keeps us alive. If you're a tree, the tree does the very opposite with the same type of molecule, the same design of molecule. What the tree does is it takes chlorophyll, which is sequestering carbon dioxide out of the air in the presence of water, some water, and also in the presence of sunlight, photonic energy from sunlight, and lo and behold, it makes oxygen, and we little creatures creep around and breathe that oxygen. So the tree can survive without us, which makes it more clever, because we cannot survive without the tree.
You know, North America was once covered in trees, and there are really very few stands of virgin forest left on this continent, but we do still have a lot of those native trees. In your book, you tell some marvelous little-known facts about, well, for one thing, the medicinal properties of trees. For example, we were talking about those native species of trees in North America. The black walnut is one of them.
Yes.
Which turns out to have some extraordinary medicinal aspects.
Well, really, the black walnut for America is probably your most extraordinary heritage tree. In the black walnut itself, if you have a child and you bring a child for a walk when they're producing the green fruit, and that would be in August for everybody in North America, get the child to hold the green fruit and get play with it for a little while. It gives them a protection to childhood leukemia.
And if you that's extraordinary.
Yeah, and it's called ellagic acid. Ellagic acid goes into the sweat glands of the child and helps the child to protect them against leukemia for about a year. And for women, all of us, because of the massive use of pesticides in the world, day after day after day after day, we're susceptible because it breaks down beta oxidation. This pesticide goes into our breast, stays in our breast, blocks beta oxidation, and we are prone to breast cancer. So what we do is we go to the black walnut, pick a couple of leaves and crunch the leaves in our hands. This is at the end of August and the beginning of September, when the compounds called ellagic acid again are highest in the tree itself. And juglone is high again as a serenading kind of complex in it. And rub the inside of your arm with the leaf, and that will give you some protection to breast cancer.
What happened to America's native black walnut forests?
Oh, we've only got 60 acres left, and it is in the central part of America. The trees were cut down, and the trees are extremely valuable. And now, any of your listeners out there, if any of you want to become instant millionaires, you can go out and grow and plant black walnuts. One well-grown black walnut will outpace any mutual funds. You can snub your nose at Wall Street and you have got the money for your grandchild for their university education, because it can be sold at auction for $60,000, because there is not enough black walnut wood left in the world.
You know, it strikes me that what you've discovered from science about trees is simply bearing out what so many ancient mystical legends have told us about trees.
Yeah.
You're a scientist with a degree in medical biochemistry and botany.
God knows what, yeah.
But, you know, you also you also have whole chapters on magical trees and mystical forests.
Yeah.
Why is it important to see trees in both ways, using both sets of language?
You have to have an open mind. I mean, you can't have a closed mind in science. You can't go around with your eyes closed and a pair of blinkers on you. And when I was a child in Ireland, my whole family was killed off. So by the time I was 11, I was an orphan. I'm a mongrel. I'm an aristocratic mongrel, and I come from a very, very, very ancient family. That's a 5th century family in Ireland. And I was the last child of that family. And all of the old 80 and 90 year olds took me under their wing under the Brehon laws. But in the old style of the Druids, they took me under their care and they taught me all kinds of things of the Druidic times, meditation, love, nature, cures, all kinds of extraordinary things. So I would be armed, they told me, for the modern world, for the new world that I was to face. And they put on my head that I would be the last voice of the ancient Gaelic world. And indeed, some of the Druids were right.
So as the last living descendant of an ancient Druidic tradition, is there particular tree wisdom that you feel compelled to transmit to the rest of us?
Yes. Don't cut them down. Don't cut the trees down. If you cut the trees down, you kill yourself. It's really that simple. Easter Island is an example. All of the trees were cut in Easter Island and the fish went too after that and everybody died. I mean, we've got to stop this thing called greed.
You have a passage, sort of sounds fictional in the book, but it makes me think you've had this experience of standing in a forest grove, praying and leaning toward trees and opening your eyes and realizing that the trees were leaning towards you.
Yes, that did happen. The trees were listening to me as I was praying in Gaelic. The prayers of Gaelic are Naharatha Nav, these Gaelic words into the air. I was praying just in my waiting time to focus my mind for doing other things. And I found that the trees were leaning to me as I was leaning to God. And then I realized we were all leaning to the same thing and that all God was unity. This profound feeling of unity, of the song of the land calling to me. It was really quite an experience.
I'm interested that you call it the song of the land because, well, as someone who works in radio, I was especially fascinated by your chapter on trees and sound.
We're deaf and dumb. Really. I mean, we are so arrogant. We assume that because we don't hear in the region of 1 to 400 hertz, that nobody else hears this. Of course they do. Dogs do, and little children do, and cats do, and monkeys apparently do. All large things produce, well, like I say, a song of the universe. The elephants do. They produce from 0 to 400 again in messages of danger from one elephant to another, even though they're 10 miles apart. But the trees do the same thing. They're very large creatures and they produce these soft, long waves of energy that actually can be measured. And the birds are very sensitive to this, and the birds come and march to the trees that they want to march to and nest and come back to the same tree every time. But now I want you to think about something. The shape of the human body. We're shaped like a viola or a big cello. We have a neck, we have the chest, which is mostly an empty cavity, and we have our diaphragm. We are receptors. And the hearing from trees is like the feeling of a symphony. When you go into this marvelous symphony and you hear music overcomes you, it floods you, it goes through you. You are the music and you get this extraordinary feeling in your chest. And in Gaelic, in the old Gaelic world, that is called, you say, Tá an tucht a gum. I have the feeling of a squeezing in the chest. And that is the feeling of the trees.
Diana Beresford Kroger is a horticulturalist with degrees in botany and medical biochemistry. Her bio plan for North America would reforest the continent with trees planted for their medicinal, environmental, and nutritional properties. She's the author of Arboretum America and The Global Forest. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. Arthur Zients is a physicist at Amherst College. His research deals with the experimental foundations of quantum mechanics. He also has a long-standing meditative practice, and for decades he's explored the connection between science and the sacred. In fact, He's talked on various occasions with the Dalai Lama about physics and contemplative life. Zayant says the greatest scientists often have a philosophical and even spiritual understanding of reality.
Einstein repeatedly spoke about what he called a religious feeling that he had as he looked into the universe, as he applied himself to his science, as he played his piano even. There was a sense of the sublime, of the miraculous. He called it Spinoza's God, which was a kind of God of geometry, mathematics, wonder. But he rejected any notion of a personal God. And I think that for many scientists, if there is an aspect of the universe and to the work they do, it could be called the sacred. It's in the sense that Einstein spoke about it.
It's clear listening to you that you have found a way to integrate your sense of science with your sense of the sacred. Was that always true?
You know, 40 years ago, when I was 20, this was a kind of torment for me, I guess I'd say. You know, I'd abandoned conventional religious life. I'd committed myself to study of physics. But the more I studied the physics as it was given in the textbooks and in the research journals, the more distant I felt from the core dimensions of my life, the spiritual dimensions of my life. And I'd say one of the keys to the change in that relationship was the beginnings of a meditative practice. You could say exploration of the mind, which to me has many of the same disciplined elements that science has, the commitment to experience. This is not fantasy. It's a way of exploring step by step, experientially, who we are, and bringing our thought, our careful analysis to that in ways that can be productive.
Are you saying that you see in meditation a kind of science of spirituality? Are you applying the scientific method to a search for meaning?
Yes. I think you put it very succinctly. There's nothing to keep us from turning that lens of our own understanding within and exploring the nature of the mind directly, using also the kind of care, rational thought, and so forth, that we're accustomed to bringing to the outer domains.
I want to explore the ways in which you see these two streams diverging and potentially joining. And I think maybe one way is to go back and ask you why it was that at the age of 20 you had abandoned conventional religion. Was it studying science? Was it studying physics that drove you away initially from spirituality?
Well, I was raised in a relatively conventional Catholic household. I felt that there's a certain understanding of the sacraments that's had in Catholicism. Namely, it doesn't matter who the priest is, what their moral stature is, what their intelligence is. I mean, it's just a person up there who's performing a kind of ritual which transforms wine and bread into the blood and body of Christ. It doesn't matter whether you're presenting yourself in a way which is flattering or unflattering. And in many cases, the priests that I met, I didn't have a lot of respect for. That felt somehow inappropriate, that there should be a depth of spiritual striving at least. And I didn't sense that. I sensed a kind of resignation or ineffectiveness somehow within that priesthood. So I turned away from that. What I was looking for was a spirituality that was ardent and more striving, I'd say. And then I didn't find it until I took up the practices associated with that striving, namely extended meditation and contemplation. Later on, I began to realize that this practice that I was undertaking seemed to be in alignment with the kinds of experiments, if you will, that I was doing in the laboratory. In other words, they both are domains of experience, domains of empirical results, one the interior of my mind and the other the exterior of my laboratory.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? You talked earlier about Einstein's belief in what he called Spinoza's God. It seems to me, I may be wrong, that in an earlier time, there was an easier connection between science and the sacred, that someone like Einstein could be attracted to Spinoza's God while clearly being a great scientist. And he wasn't alone in this, was he?
You know, most of the early great scientists, whether it's Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Einstein, these were all extraordinarily well-educated human beings, and so they had an inherently philosophical orientation towards that which they were studying, discovering, bringing into the world. They weren't technicians, if you will. They were thoughtful, reflective, you could even say contemplative in their approach to the mysteries they were unearthing. And in a very short period of time, you know, miraculous things were being brought into the world. And so when they went off walking together, which they often did, or sailing on the seas of Germany and Austria and the like, they had the most extraordinary conversations. Heisenberg documents them, and they are ruminating on the implications of what they're doing constantly, because they realize it's a whole new universe now. Space and time have been changed. The fundamental laws of the micro world have been discovered and found to be quite different than anything that classical physics had presented. What in the world could this mean, and mean in the largest possible sense about our own nature, how we know the world, and so on? So these are the most powerful existential issues that we confront. Now, that brought them, you could say, into the domain of the sacred, but most of them shied away from and even were rather clear about the fact that this did not mean that they adopted a conventional religious life or attitude. They stayed on this side of that divide.
Well, because there are a lot of things to ask you about that, but this thing that strikes me right away, given the subject that we're discussing, can science be sacred, is that so few of your colleagues these days seem to be talking about these things. I mean, Stephen Hawking has just written a book arguing that science is all you need, that science itself can explain the origins of the universe. And he says that philosophy is dead because it hasn't kept up with developments in modern science. What's going on? Why would a scientist of Hawking's stature want to say that?
Well, there's a kind of interesting way in which I agree with Hawking. So in one sense, it should be obvious that I'm completely coming at this whole question from another standpoint, from another angle. At the same time, I think he's right. Simone Weil had this great line where she says, "The absence of God is the most marvelous testimony of perfect love." One of the favorite lines of mine, the absence of God. In some sense, the greatest gift that the sacred can offer us is its absence. If God were everywhere present, then there would be no question about belief in God, right? It'd be basically like believing in chairs and tables. But the absence of God poses a question: is there or isn't there? Is there the sacred or is there not? Is it something we can come to know or not? In other words, we're left free. And I think that gift of freedom is one of the most important and significant aspects of our lives. Now, what that means is God is plausibly deniable, you know, is in a position where it's unclear whether there is a God or isn't a God. So Stephen Hawking can say, "I don't think there is one." And he can be arguing from a clear and adequate understanding of science. On the other hand, I think if one engages the question more fully, becomes more reflective, more contemplative, explores the inner life, one begins to develop a sense that, no, this world, both the outer world of science, but also the inner world of contemplative experience, demands in the end that we acknowledge the existence of something beyond ourselves, which we might call the sacred. So I think he rightly points to the fact that God is not necessary for a physical universe. But you can ask, you know, is he necessary for an inner or moral universe that we discover within? And in my experience is, to an objective, open-minded awareness, yes.
That's Arthur Zients, a physicist at Amherst College. He's been one of the organizers of the Mind and Life Dialogues between scientists and the Dalai Lama. Every so often, a wildlife biologist will pull back the cloak of science and reveal something highly personal. It's the case with Birute Galdikas, the world's best-known orangutan expert. One of Louis Leakey's protégés, she was the first person to do a long-term field study in Borneo. Galdikas says her encounters with wild orangutans have, at times, felt otherworldly, especially when she has stared into their eyes and they've looked back at her.
It's almost like finding God. It's a powerful moment of transcendence. It's suddenly you realize that you're not alone in the universe. And those moments were very, very powerful. And of course, they came from the fact that there was total, absolutely total isolation. And they came out of the fact that there was total acceptance on the part of the orangutans, and possibly on my part as well, of the situation. And those moments had the intensity of a religious experience. the setting does reflect, you know, the kind of setting that we have in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques. There's sort of these beams of light, you know, that shoot from the sky, and there's a sort of a hush and a quiet. And I think that what churches try to do is they try to duplicate, you know, the ancient forest from which we came. And so, like, when you go into the forest, it's like going into a church, but not into a church created by humans, into the original church, into the original, you know, Garden of Eden, which was our home, which is where we became human. These kinds of experiences help explain why people frequently become almost addicted to helping certain species, or become addicted to nature. It's because they find something there that they can find no place else.
That's Baruta Galdikas of the Orangutan Foundation International. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Can Science Be Sacred? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.